it's entirely about profiteering. What's so important about this cop is that people should celebrate the fact that that obstruction is not here and pass as fast as possible mechanisms like a fossil fuel phase out roadmap where the U.S. is not here, but they could be bound by it later when they join. And that's the importance of this COP. We actually need a game plan to phase out fossil fuels in a funded manner. And if we can pass that here, the U.S. as the number one historic emitter and as one of the wealthiest countries in the world will have to abide by it when it comes back.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Jean Hsu is the Energy Justice Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. We'll link to their new report, Data Crunch, How the AI Boom Threatens to Entrench Fossil Fuels and Compromise Climate Goals. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes. I want to thank Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Dennis Moynihan, Sam Alkoff, Tarina Nadura, who are our Berlin team on the ground, and also Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Safwat Nizal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Thank you also to Becca Staley and to our whole team on the ground in New York, John Randolph and Paul Powell and Miguel Nogueira. I'm Amy Goodman from Belém, Brazil. Thank you for
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
That's fine.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the state of Oregon pushes back yet again against a Trump administration grab of voter data.
PacifiCorp settles yet another class action lawsuit for not shutting down power in the 2020 Labor Day fires.
And Trump officials say SNAP recipients must reapply for benefits.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 19th, 2025. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne. Oregon Secretary of State Tobias Reed and state election officials demand answers from the Trump administration with regards to how private information from states' voter rolls is being used. Oregon joins the state of Washington and eight other states who are concerned the U.S. Department of Justice improperly shared voter data with the Department of Homeland Security and report they have all received inconsistent and misleading information from both departments. Secretary of State Reid said, quote, "This is exactly why I refuse to give up Oregonians' private voter data, because we can't trust how it will be used by this lawless, cruel administration. I'm deeply concerned that they are hiding the truth from the American people. They are not properly securing this data, and they'll use it to keep tearing families and communities apart," end quote. The Justice Department demanded information from voter rolls that include Social Security numbers and birth dates. Reed refused, saying the federal government's request went beyond its authority. In their letter, the secretaries listed several questions they wanted the DOJ and DHS to answer before Monday, December 1st. In September, the Justice Department sued Oregon and the state of Maine, and soon after, six more states, because it claims those states violated federal law. Assistant U.S. Attorney General Harmeet K. Dillon of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division said in a news release, quote, "States simply cannot pick and choose which federal laws they will comply with, including our voting laws, which ensure they that all American citizens have equal access to the ballot in federal elections, end quote.
Four Oregon counties must comply with a subpoena issued by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Earlier this week, U.S. District Judge Michael McShane granted a petition filed by the federal government that asked it to direct Multnomah, Clackamas, Marion, and Washington counties to cooperate with subpoenas for 10 recently released inmates. Judge McShane's order is in response to a petition filed by the U.S. Attorney's Office last month when it asked him to enforce 10 administrative immigration subpoenas sent, asking a judge to decide if it could provide the records. The lawsuit also asked a judge to advise on what the county describes as conflicts between Oregon sanctuary law, state public records law, and federal law. That case currently remains open. Oregon sanctuary law generally bars agencies from sharing information with ICE with immigration enforcement purposes unless ordered to do so by a judge. When agencies receive administrative subpoenas signed by federal agents rather than a judge, Oregon law prohibits them from cooperating.
Oregon's second largest electric utility company, PacifiCorp, reached a $150 million settlement with 1,434 plaintiffs. The company has settled nearly 4,200 wildfire claims for $1.6 billion, which represents roughly 70% of individual claims in California and Oregon. The set of plaintiffs originally asked for $30 billion, which was filed after a jury found the electric utility company responsible when it failed to shut off electric service to its customers during a severe windstorm. The fire started in multiple locations and burned nearly 1.2 million acres, completely burning down some local communities. The fires were so destructive that Portland and much of Western Oregon had the worst air quality in the world at the time. Ryan Flynn, president of PacifiCorp, said, quote, "We are doing the responsible thing, and we are gratified to resolve these claims to provide plaintiffs with some closure to move on. The process that led to this settlement represents the fairest and most efficient way to resolve wildfire litigation. Class action litigation is costly, complex, takes several years to run its course, and is a barrier to reasonable outcomes," end quote. PacifiCorp was purchased by Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway in 2006 for $5.1 billion. In Oregon, Washington, and Northern California, the utility operates under the name Pacific Power. In Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming, the company operates as Rocky Mountain Power.
Oregon universities seem unlikely to sign on to a Trump administration demand for higher education institutions. The U.S. Department of Education's, quote, Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education outlines provisions the schools must adhere to, including sets of admissions requirements, campus free speech policies, and changes to faculty hiring. The compact does not explicitly state how universities benefit from the arrangement, but it hints at student loan access, research funding, approval of student and faculty visas, and tax advantages. The deadline to sign on is quickly approaching. Colleges and universities throughout the U.S. have until this Friday to comply. So far, none of Oregon's higher education institutions have publicly put their names onto the document. Oregon Public Broadcasting reporting found nearly all of the state's public universities claimed that they had not been contacted by the federal government about it or that they did not plan to sign it. Portland State University spokesperson Katie Swordfisk said, quote, "While Portland State has not been asked to sign this compact, our commitment to equity, inclusion, and academic freedom is unwavering. We will not endorse any measure that contradicts our core values or hinders our work to build a campus where every student and employee can thrive," end quote. Of the nearly 6,000 institutions in the U.S., only three have indicated interest in joining the compact. Some advocacy groups immediately described the proposal as a thinly veiled bribe, offering preferential treatment to schools willing to comply with the administration's priorities. United Academics of the University of Oregon has created its own agreement called the Oregon Compact on Higher Education. The document apparently calls on the academic community to preserve, protect, and defend institutions. One of its faculty union leaders, Bonnie Mann, said, quote, "We recognized the Trump administration, rather the Trump compact, as a loyalty oath for higher education institutions, sort of a way to create loyalty to a leader. But we're supposed to be loyal to a sense of education for the common good," end quote.
Portland City Council is poised to vote on a ban on using AI algorithms to set rental prices in the city tonight. The proposal would ban the use of this type of price fixing. Oregon is a party to a federal lawsuit against one service like this, RealPage. The suit alleges that the companies like RealPage aggregate data from hundreds of large landlords and suggest rental pricing, inflating the price of the rental market. It's even alleged that they will recommend that landlords and property managers leave units empty in order to inflate the value of the units. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield is set to settle a rental price fixing suit with the large landlord Graystar. Graystar allegedly used RealPage to coordinate rent increases in Oregon and 8 other states. If the court accepts the settlement, Oregon will get $7 million as a settlement and cooperation from Graystar in the lawsuit against RealPage. Rayfield said, quote, "When the largest landlord in America uses an algorithm to price fix the rent, the result is simple. People pay more. It squeezes working families with the cost of housing is already at an all-time high. This settlement holds the largest U.S. landlord accountable. It's a win for Oregonians, our pocketbooks, and the rule of law," end quote. Locally, proponents of the ban say it will help lower rents, and it won't hurt small landlords since you have to own a lot of properties to even qualify to use the service. Industry groups have pushed back, saying it will push away developers. Portland City Council meets at 6 p.m. this evening.
Portland City Council will consider an ordinance that would create a new fee for landlords who rent their properties out as detention facilities. Government-owned detention facilities would be exempt. City Councilor Annalita Murillo put the fee forward as a way for the city to recoup some costs that come from the facility being in the city, namely the environmental impact on the surrounding neighborhood and the police resources dedicated to a site of protest activity. The group Portland Contra las Diputaciones is opposed to the ordinance and plans to rally outside City Council tonight. They say the fee is, quote, performative, and calls on City Council to revoke the ICE facility's permit. Portland has issued a land use violation notice to the detention facility more than 60 days ago, which the landlord is appealing.
A federal court's ruling on Texas congressional map sends the redistricting battle to the Supreme Court. While the state's governor labels a Muslim civil rights group a terrorist organization, and cities deal with shifting federal energy policy and the shutdown. With that story and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
And he can issue what's called an administrative stay. That's to put this on hold for a short period of time, even a day or 2 days or 3 days or a week, until the full court can consider it.
South Texas College of Law professor Josh Blackman says conservative Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito will decide on an emergency request to review a federal court's decision to block Texas's new redrawn congressional maps as a racial gerrymander. The lower court's ruling sets off an immediate scramble over what election rules will govern midterms there, and the high court could pause the ruling, uphold it, or revert to previous maps. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has formally designated the nation's most important Muslim civil rights group as a foreign terrorist organization without providing any proof. Robert McCall with the Council on American Islamic Relations says Abbott's declaration has no legal or factual basis.
The governor of Texas has no authority to unilaterally declare any Americans or American institutions as hostile to the United States. And so this is a publicity stunt, and we're going to push back.
CARE argues the move is retaliation for its criticism of U.S. policy in Gaza. The U.S. Senate has unanimously agreed to advance a House bill requiring the Justice Department to release the Jeffrey Epstein case files within 30 days. The measure now heads to President Donald Trump, who says he'll sign it despite previously opposing disclosure. Lawmakers in both parties are celebrating the move, while Democrats warn the Justice Department could still try to limit what becomes public. The New York Times is reporting that Trump has approved CIA plans for covert action in Venezuela. In Indiana, political tensions continue to rise as lawmakers weigh redistricting demands from Trump and Governor Mike Braun. Some Republican lawmakers there are unusually resistant. Indiana Senate President Rod Bray says the legislature doesn't typically make changes of that magnitude without a chance to debate them.
We don't typically come in a special session for that. We do it early in January. We understand we have to do it relatively quickly.
Some Republicans argue reopening the maps now could strengthen representation, while others warn mid-cycle changes would be disruptive and politically driven. Legislative leaders are expected to outline next steps for the 2026 session later this week. In Cincinnati, local leaders are scrambling to move clean energy work forward even as federal funding fluctuates. Ollie Kroner, director of Cincinnati's Office of Environment and Sustainability, says cities are adapting in real time, first to cuts from the administration and now to the aftermath of the shutdown.
Energy is at the center of the equation. The more we can invest in clean energy, the more we can march towards our climate goals and deliver more affordable energy for the people in our cities.
He says inflation and rising energy costs are making the efforts more important. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6, it's Radio Zine. At 6:30, look for Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, you want to stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, expect clouds with an overnight low of about 39 degrees. Tomorrow, expect some early morning rain with more clouds. Afternoon high of about 53. Today in history, in 1805, the Lewis and Clark Expedition, also known as the Corps of Discovery, was led by Sacagawea, York, Meriwether Lewis, and William Clark. They reached the Pacific coast, the first European Americans to cross the West. The quote of the day is from American essayist, poet, philosopher, and naturalist Henry David Thoreau, who said, quote, "Go confidently in the direction of your dreams. Live the life you have imagined," end quote.
For too many years, Indigenous women and women of color across the U.S. have endured forced sterilization without informed consent. Last week, a coalition of women's reproductive rights advocates called on New Mexico legislators to create a commission to investigate the abuses. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. For decades, starting in 1907, Indigenous women and women of color across the country were sterilized without their informed consent. Last week, a coalition of women's reproductive rights advocates called on New Mexico legislators to create a commission to investigate the abuses. KUNM's Jeanette DeDios has more.
Numerous reports show sterilizations peaked in the 1960s through the late 70s. That's when upwards of 70,000 Indigenous women were forced or coerced into sterilization procedures by the Indian Health Service and contracted physicians, including those at the University of New Mexico. By the mid-1970s, at least 25% of Indigenous women of childbearing age had been sterilized. Executive Director of Indigenous Women Rising, Rachel Lorenzo from the Mescalero Apache in Laguna Pueblo, says she was a target of coercion.
Doctors refused to take out my IUD, despite the fact the copper IUD, which is called Paragard, made me bleed for 10 months, and four different doctors refused to take it out because it was working the way it was supposed to. And they said I was too young at 22 to have another baby.
The proposed joint memorial would establish a memorial to victims, but also a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that would make New Mexico the first U.S. state to formally investigate and acknowledge the violations done to Indigenous women. Democratic State Senator Linda Lopez agreed that the legislature needs to acknowledge the role New Mexico played in this history.
It wasn't us who are here in the roundhouse at this point in time. And yes, it was maybe another governmental entity, but Madam Chair, I think those of us who are elected have a responsibility to say this should never have happened, this will not happen, and that we apologize.
Democratic State Representative Michelle Paulina Beda says there also needs to be more resources for educating youth about reproductive care. New Mexico currently doesn't have a law on forced sterilization. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette DiDios.
The Native vote was center stage Tuesday morning at the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention in Seattle. Panelists discussed various barriers facing Native voters and efforts to protect Native voting rights. Matthew Campbell, deputy director at the Native American Rights Fund, was on the panel. He says the state of the Native votes across the country has its ups and downs.
Typically, a voter might choose to only vote in the presidential election every 4 years. But I think it's really critical to remember that if we elect candidates of our choice in the state legislature, for the school boards, you know, every single race really can make a difference in our lives. You know, if we elect people that lift up and fight for tribal sovereignty at the state level, that's really important. And if we elect people that are aware about our culture and our tradition at the school board level, that's also really important.
Janie Parrish is the executive director of Arizona Native Vote. She says work on Native voting issues takes place year-round and not just during big election years like presidential or midterms.
Like many issues, whether it's tribal sovereignty, climate, education, there are people constantly working on these issues, whether that's on advocacy side or lobbying or policy. It's the same thing with civic engagement and voting and elections.
Parrish is a panelist on civic engagement in Indian Country Wednesday afternoon. Voting is just one of the many issues attendees of the NCEI Annual Convention are focusing on. Organizers say this year's convention is seeing record numbers, with 2,500 people registered. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
The public comment period to rescind the public lands rule has closed. After garnering over 150,000 comments, almost all of which were in support of keeping the rule, proponents say the rule would help the Bureau of Land Management balance conservation with natural resource development. KBOO's Gary Taylor has the details.
The Trump administration is planning to rescind the public lands rule. Proponents say it would help the Bureau of Land Management restore landscapes, plan for responsible development, and protect cultural and natural resources. A comment period for the ending of the rule garnered more than 150,000 comments, almost all of which were in favor of keeping it. Mark Salvo is with the Oregon Natural Desert Association. He says at a time when invasive species, wildfire, climate change, and other serious threats loom over the state's southeastern public lands, revoking the rule would be a missed opportunity.
This rule could have been, still could be, really important to not only those lands, wildlife, and watersheds in eastern Oregon, but for the multitude of recreationists, communities, regional economies that depend on those resources.
The BLM manages nearly 15 million acres of public land in Oregon, largely east of the Cascades. Salvo says his organization is part of a coalition of sporting groups, tribes, local businesses, and local jurisdictions who are all in support of the regulation. It is unknown when the final decision on whether to rescind the rule will be made. Opponents argue the public lands rule would limit grazing and resource extraction by prioritizing conservation while hindering local control over public land. But Salvo argues it would allow communities to engage more directly with the BLM to restore public lands. He adds the rule is essential for the Bureau to fulfill its 50-year-old mandate to balance conservation with other uses.
There was never any proven concern that development would somehow be curtailed just because we were also ensuring that conservation and restoration would be treated as a co-equal multiple use on those landscapes.
While the high deserts of eastern Oregon may be taking a blow from the federal level, Salvo says he is inspired by the care for the land that local communities and state leadership continue to show.
The number of people and the resources and their commitment to addressing these problems is impressive and increasing over time.
A coalition of 61 members of Congress and over 180 local officials from every Western state joined public comments opposing the end of the rule. For KBOO News and Oregon News Service, I'm Gary Taylor reporting.
Trump administration officials want SNAP recipients to reapply for benefits. That's despite the fact that most places require updated data from folks who get food assistance every 6 months to a year. Brooke Rollins is the Secretary of Agriculture. She went on the far-right news channel Newsmax to declare that people will have to reapply. She said reapplication would, quote, give us a platform and a trajectory to fundamentally rebuild this program, have everyone reapply for their benefits, make sure that everyone that's taking a taxpayer-funded benefit through SNAP or food stamps, that they literally are vulnerable and they can't survive without it, end quote. No official details have been released for the reapplication process, including whether it would be states' responsibility or federal government's, and what the timeline would be. Work requirements included in the Big Beautiful Bill Act could lead to millions being removed from SNAP over the next few years. It includes new requirements from homeless people, veterans, young adults who age out of foster care, refugees, asylum seekers, and human trafficking victims. Joel Berg is with the relief organization Hunger Free America. Burge told ABC News, quote, there's no question this is going to create more harm and suffering and hunger.
The Trump administration plans an aggressive dismantling of the Education Department. They say they'll end the agency's broad role in supporting academics at elementary and high schools and in expanding access to college. Most of those responsibilities will instead be taken over by the Labor Department. Other Education Department programs will be transferred to the Health and Human Services, State and Interior Departments. Education Secretary Linda McMahon said, quote, cutting through layers of red tape in Washington is one essential piece of our final mission. Becky Pringle, president of the National Education Association, said, quote, Donald Trump and his administration chose American Education Week, a time when our nation is celebrating students, public schools, and educators, to announce their illegal plan to further abandon students by dismantling the Department of Education. She continued, quote, not only do they want to starve and steal from our students, they want to rob them of their futures. Completely eliminating the Department of Education would require an act of Congress.
KBOO's poet Dan Raphael says his political weather forecast is an 85% chance of the unexpected.
It wouldn't change our current lives to find out who killed JFK, but knowing who murdered Jeffrey Epstein might give us a clear idea of who's in charge, who's paid for Project 2025 and keeps pulling Trump's strings, and what we might do to turn the autocratic tide. I don't think anyone's out to get me, but I'm still paranoid. I know that the financial world today is fairly borderless because, mansions, super yachts, and private islands aside, most big money has no physical presence, can be anywhere today and somewhere else tomorrow. Investing in Russia or China has built-in political difficulties. Europe is Europe, borderless while territorial, and most of the rest of the world's too hungry to think of expanding in time or territory, so big money still loves America. There's enough uncertainty in my personal life, in the near future of Portland and Oregon, that I've no bandwidth to even speculate what might be coming down from the skies of global economics and politics. What's in front of me now? What's for dinner? What joy could tomorrow bring? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 19th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, Althea Billings, Dave Johnson, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Brian Bull, Farah Siddiqui, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to Street Roots Radio. I'm Hannah Francis. Street Roots is a nonprofit organization in Portland, Oregon that creates income opportunities for people experiencing homelessness and poverty by producing a newspaper and other media that are catalysts for individual and social change. Today, we are talking about Street Roots correspondent Jake Thomas's new article, No Strings Attached, Oregon Has Joined an Experiment Looking Into Whether Cash Plus Parent-Like Support Will Help Young People Living Outside From Homelessness to Housing and Jobs. I'm here with Street Roots correspondent Jake Thomas. Welcome to the show, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So your article starts out with the story of a young woman who was recently housed through this program that you focus on. Could you tell me a little bit more about her story and experience with homelessness?
So I talked to Gabby Huffman. She lives in the Bend area, and her story starts.